This morning's sermon is taken from the following verses, 1 Corinthians 12:27 through 14:1, and Mark 10:35 through 45.
So we come this morning to our last week in Eastertide. Next week is Pentecost, and so you'll want to come with your most thirsty soul to finally respond, as we all have an invitation to be filled afresh with the Holy Spirit. So these 7 weeks of Eastertide, we've been looking at the person and power of the Spirit in the formation of the church, and how he both forms the church inwardly as we minister to one another in gifts that help build fruit in us, and how he empowers and authorizes the church to be his ambassadors in the world. So over these 7 weeks, we've seen that the biblical sweep of the Spirit's work is quite awesome. We see the Spirit at work in creation, in supervising history, in revealing God's truth, in drawing people to Jesus, in teaching us the way of Jesus. And one of my favorite passages, Romans 5:5, that the Spirit of God sheds abroad in our hearts, or in maybe a little more easy English, reveals the love of God to our hearts. I mean, that alone leaves you with a very beautiful picture of the person and work of the Spirit. And he does, though, give us power, that is to say, the capacity to work in his name, the authority. He authorizes us to do it. He gives us equipping gifts, transforms our heart via fruit, that sort of thing. So the essential thing that I've wanted to set before you, and you know, I've said a couple times kiddingly, because it's actually not like really a big deal to me, but I just like know what I know about various points of view in the church, that at a minimum, even if you come from a place where you've been kind of a little cautious about the Spirit or not wondered, or maybe you've had off-putting experiences around Pentecostals or something, at the very least, I want to try to lead you to at least this narrative logic that emerges from our scriptures. Jesus, the one you say you trust and love, said this: "It's better that I go away." So I get it, even if you've had some uncomfortable experiences around Pentecostals or Charismatics or something, if you're going to be intellectually honest, you have to ask, why is that uncomfortable thing determinative? Why is not the words of your Lord determinative? It's better that I go away. Because if I go away, the Spirit will come. And when the Spirit comes, he'll lead you and teach you and guide you in the very same way that I have been. He'll be with you. I'm going away. I'm going to ascend to the right hand of the Father, but the Spirit will remain with you. Now, so just following the narrative logic, you know, without getting into a lot of systematic theology or whatever, just follow the narrative. Jesus comes, he does his thing, says it's better that I go away. And then I would just ask you to consider reading Paul, you know, Ephesians, 1 Corinthians, we've read now a couple times, and Romans. Read those gifts passages in the New Testament, something like this: oh, this is the way this is happening. Jesus said it was better if he went, because the Spirit would come. And just read these gifts passages as not exhaustive. They're not a catalog. They're representative. Oh, this is how the Spirit's leading the church. He's giving us leadership and people who can see from God's angle, prophets. He's giving us evangelists and teachers and people with gifts of wisdom and gifts of knowledge and discerning of spirits and helps and all these gifts. And I think you should just read Paul going, well, I'll be darned. Jesus was right. And who would have thunk it, but this is the way it's happening. This is how the body is ministering to one another. Because come on again, just think with me for a minute. I know it's a Sunday morning, but think with me for a minute. They would have had no imagination. Come on, think with me. How could they have had any imagination for how what Jesus said was going to happen would have unfolded? We now think we have an imagination with 2,000 years of hindsight. They just had this obscure saying that made no sense. And so I think it's very honest to the text to just hear the early church going, well, I'll be darned. This is how Jesus' promise is coming forward. So I just want you to know, like, heart of hearts, keeping it real, my heart to your heart, I care very much. I mean, I guess other than my family, there's nothing I care more about in the world than the upbuilding, or, you know, the New Testament word, the edifying of this church and us ministering to each other. And there's nothing I care more about than us learning to be God's people in the world, in your everyday, ordinary life. You're eating, sleeping, getting up, walking around life. I care dearly that you place that before God as an offering and that you are his ministers. But I care equally about how that happens. I care equally about the values that undergird such a thing. Which leads me to what I want to do this morning, and that is to help us ask and answer the question, what values should give shape to the church as she ministers to one another and ministers to the world? And again, I'm going to ask you to use your imagination right now. How do you suppose the church was shaped after Jesus had said this, but there was no Bible? So I want you to picture the church with no Bible, the church with no formal hierarchy. Nothing like we would think of as a church staff or a presbytery or a vestry or a congregational vote. No systems like that. So no apparent hierarchy. Now, I'm aware the apostles were around, but not the way we think of like formal institutional hierarchy today, maybe best to put it that way. So no Bible, no institutional hierarchy, and you know, no apparent way to structure themselves. How did they do this? What was the value system that undergirded their life together and their interaction with babies left on the side of the road and sexually abused 14-year-old boys who had been tortured in the Roman culture? What undergirded their interactions with each other and with their broken world? And we just heard Vivian read it to us this morning. Love. Because if you ever found yourself on a remote island with no Bible, no visible hierarchical leadership in the church, nothing like that to guide you, what would guide you? And our text, just not just this morning, but everywhere, wants to say, here's what should guide you. Willing the good of others. Altruistic edification. Altruism simply meaning doing good to others with expecting nothing in return. What the Bible does imagine the church doing is expressing selfless concern for the well-being of others, giving without expecting anything in return. Did you know that altruism is actually kind of a more common word in zoology and biology than it is in social psychology? Because the animal world is actually full of animals benefiting others at their own expense. Maybe the easiest one to imagine is wolves, who go out, gather around an animal much larger than they could handle themselves, kill the animal, and then take the meat back to the den and share it with wolves who weren't there to be a part of the kill, who you would think they don't deserve it. But they take it back and they share it. And the picture here in the New Testament is that love is the indispensable core aspect of life in God. So I don't know why something in me always feels begging. Like, I just want you to get this. Like, what if we took Paul serious for the minute this morning? And he says, without love, I and my work am nothing. Now, but, you know, maybe he thought he was just writing poetry for Christian weddings. Or for the funerals of people who were particularly humanitarians or something. Except for what if Paul really had experiences like caught up into the third heaven, spoke in tongues more than anybody, prophesied, saw healing, saw the dead raised? What if that was all true? What if this isn't rhetoric? What if Paul is reflecting on his actual life and saying, you know, without love, all of that adds up to nothing. I am nothing. And these things are nothing. Unless they're embedded in this will to the good of the other. If they're not embedded in that, then what does my caught up into the third heaven amount to? Are you feeling me here? What if this isn't rhetoric? What if Paul's really representing reality here? So 1 Corinthians wants to help us think through what kind of spirit-filled person or spirit-gifted community is in view in the Bible. What does it look like to love or will the good of someone? And I love the way Eugene gets this in the Message, where he says, well, here's what you do. You don't give up on others. You care for others more than you care for yourself. You don't spend your life wanting what you don't have. You don't strut. You don't have a swelled head. Love doesn't force itself on others. It doesn't say me first. It doesn't fly off the handle. It doesn't keep score of the sins of others. It doesn't revel when others grovel. Love takes pleasure in the flowering of truth, puts up with anything, trusts God's always, and always look for the best. Now here is one of the most important things I've said to you in this series and may ever say to you. Don't you dare turn these into guilt-ridden commands. This is not Paul putting something on you to make you feel guilty because, well, I do revel a little bit when others are groveling. Or, you know, I'm not always putting others first. This is not what's being said here. This isn't a new Ten Commandments. This isn't a new legalism. If you listen carefully to what Paul says, he says this is what love does. So then you ask yourself, if you're thinking with me, well, then what do I do? Okay, everybody look me in the eye. You fill yourself with God's love. You position yourself to receive God's love. And then as we'll talk about more next week at Pentecost, John 7, the vision of the New Testament, is then that out of your innermost being will come gushing torrents of living water that is for the good of others. That's what we do. Our job is to just be with Jesus, to be filled with the love of God, and as we're filled with that love, this is what love does. This is not what legalistic Christians do. This is not what shame-filled Christians do. This is not what guilt-ridden Christians do because they know they can't do this. This is what love does when it flows naturally from those who are drinking of love. So then when we get to our gospel reading this morning, what we really see is kind of the antithesis or the opposite of this, because in Mark 10, if you look at your passage there, it's ambition that underlies James and John's question. And you got to remember that these are two of Jesus's three closest friends. And so even they're confused. And I don't want you to see them here as like cheesy, greedy sinners. I want you to see a way more profound and fundamental misunderstanding about the nature of power. They thought that to do good, you had to first amass power. And in human societies, power is sort of like a pie, like picture an apple pie. And if I take a slice, that means there's less for all of you. Right? Are you feeling me here? There's only one pie. If I take a slice, there's less for all of you. And what does that lead to? Human fighting. Every time. And this is what's going on in James and John's head. It's rooted in a misunderstanding of how things actually work. They didn't really get Jesus' kingdom way of being in the world. That, listen to me, did not necessitate amassing power. Just always go back to Maundy Thursday. Jesus, knowing from where he'd come and where he was going, got up, took off his robes, went to the back corner, found the basin of water, and washed his disciples' feet. Why? He had no need to amass power. He didn't need anything from anybody. He had heard his father say, before he'd done anything in public, you're my beloved son. With you I'm well pleased. He knew where he'd come from. He knew where he was going. And it was out of that reality that he was able to then just do what he did without having to get power from others. Now, that's the vision I want to leave you with when it comes to this business of 1 Corinthians 13 love. What if we could hook into something like that? Knowing from where we'd come, Psalm 139, before you were born, I knit you in your mother's womb. Jeremiah 1, before you were appointed a prophet, I knew you. What if we could say, knowing from where I'd come and knowing where I'm going, that I'm a never-ceasing spiritual being with an incredible future in God's great unfolding cosmos. This is where I've come from, divine intention. This is where I'm going, divine telos. And this makes meaning of my life. And in that, I don't then have to grab for other power. What more power could there be than the divine initiative in my life? So you see how this is a much, much bigger deal than simply them being cheesy, you know, power grabbers or something. There's a big fundamental misunderstanding happening. And this is why Jesus says, look at your text, it's not going to be that way with you. For with you, whoever would be great among you is not the one with the most power. It's the one who has the most will to the good of others. That's a servant. So the one who's a servant is the greatest. Whoever's to be first amongst you must be a slave of all. And then comes this powerful logic, and this is the verse that all of us know. But I want you to listen to the logic of Mark. For even, that's a very strong logical connective in this paragraph. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom. Now, I would venture to guess that 95% of evangelical Christians read this passage as a passage on salvation, and of course it is. Jesus did give his life a ransom to free us from our sins. But if we're to be honest with this, in the context, it's more than that. This is about what you might say sociologically, politics, or if we wanted to bring it down a little bit, this is about human relations. This is about how humans are with each other in marriage, in business, in neighborhoods. So when Jesus says, I've come to suffer and die for others, the political statement, the social, relational statement is this: not to tyrannize others. Because in what we think of as like first century, you know, middle part of the Mediterranean, all they knew of powers were that they tyrannized others. Men tyrannized boys, and men tyrannized women, and women, when they could, tyrannized each other. This was fundamental, basic behavior. Leaders were just really good at it. And so they rose to the top of the pyramid of tyranny. This is what Jesus is saying. Yes, it is about our salvation and about our going to heaven, but it's more. It's answering the misunderstanding of James and John about how human power is meant to work. And Jesus is saying, I am not here for self-gain as normal cultural leaders. Jesus is saying, here's a model way of using positions of leadership and of power. Mimic this. So now hear the narrative again. Jesus had a manner of being in the world. Way. Truth, life. I'm leaving. But it would be better for you if I go, because I will send the Spirit. And when the Spirit comes, part of what he will do is transform your fundamental misunderstandings and default positions. And core to that is learning to be someone who is so safe in God's love, so nourished yourself, that others are not for you, you are for others. Now you just imagine humanity living into that vision. Imagine a marriage in which the persons of the marriage fundamentally will the good of the other. The other is not for them to use. And picture work environments in which people don't think, these are all extras in a movie about me, but that I'm here for them. You just think, this is why you hear me say all the time, I am a freaking Jesus freak. I think he's stunningly brilliant. I think he has the best information possible on the most important aspects of what it means to be human. I trust his vision. I'm betting my life on God and his kingdom. Because I think humankind would actually be better. So then, just let me say a couple of things, and then we'll transition into our baptism and dedications. But I just want to leave you before we get to Pentecost next week, and you know I don't get to talk about this much. I want to give you, at least just from my heart to yours, what I hope will be the values that undergird our ministry to each other and our ministry in the world. And the first one is this, the golden rule. Like if you just don't know what to do, like if you're praying for somebody in this room or on the patio and you're just a little confused and don't know what to do, if you just follow the golden rule, you're not going to go too far wrong. Just don't do anything to somebody that you wouldn't want done to you. And don't fail to do something to somebody that you would want done to you. If you just don't know where else to go, like if you don't know how to be a charismatic, then, you know, just follow the golden rule. Inspired by the Spirit, and you'll be pretty good. Next, no hype. I mean, that's probably not going to shock any of you who come here, but we just don't do hype. It's long-term bad. It's bad for our souls, long-term bad for communities. I've seen it over and over and over again. We don't do hype. And we don't do manipulation, right? I mean, this is just fundamental, right? If as soon as you have it right that I exist for others, others don't exist for me, that automatically banishes manipulation. You only manipulate people who have something you want. As soon as you don't want it, well, manipulation just naturally goes out the window. But we don't manipulate. And furthermore, number four, when you're feeling inspired by the Spirit and you feel a kind of gift or movement of the Spirit coming through you, that as much as possible, we want to be natural about it. We don't take on errors, you know, we don't take on a different tone of voice or, you know, body language, or we're just natural about it. And we act with humility, as I talked about with Jesus's foot washing. That in his foot washing, this was an expression of positional power that's rooted in a fundamental confidence in God. And I want us to have that, this fundamental humility. And then next, out of that fundamental humility will come kind of a tentativeness, right? So, you know, I could wake up one morning with, say, Alan on my mind, and I have this thought about Alan, my friend, and I pray for him for a bit before I get out of bed, and I feel something. So if I saw Alan or called him, I wouldn't say to Alan, "Alan, thus saith the Lord, you have to do this." I would say, "Alan, I might be crazy, but I got to just be honest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." But whenever we're ministering to people, the most important thing you can remember is that God himself so trusts your, or so values your life in him, that even he doesn't manipulate you. He let the rich young ruler turn and walk away. So even when we're giving each other words or whatever, it should always be tentative, leaving the hearer of these words in control of their life before God. And truly, I don't hardly ever say stuff like this. I don't think I've ever said anything like this. But I will not allow anything other than that. There will be no manipulating, no bullying, no rising up on people. I just, if I see it, I won't, just telling you, I won't tolerate it, because this won't be a safe place. This has to be a safe place where we can both take risks and say, "I don't know, Alan, I might be crazy," but where we take those kind of risks, but we take them in a gentle humility, where we're always creating and respecting human space, not taking it away. But at the end of the day, and we'll say more about this next week, we have to act. What's envisioned in the New Testament is an interactive relationship between the Holy Spirit and the church, so that we come to trust that actually out of our lives will come gushing these torrents of living water for the sake of others.